This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Chip and Dale, and Spider-Man? Disney bought Marvel Entertainment today, betting that Hannah Montana and Iron Man are going to be a great 1-2 punch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday, everybody. It is the 31st of August today. I have no idea what the actual box office take this weekend was for whichever movies are out, but $4 billion is a pretty good place to start. That's how much the Walt Disney Company said this morning that it will pay for Marvel Entertainment. The comic book giant gets a whopping premium over its stock price last Friday. Disney gets more than 5,000 characters in return, including Spider-Man, the X-Men, and Iron Man. That is some serious manpower. And as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, that is exactly the point.
To you or me, Disney might mean Mickey Mouse, Peter Pan, or Aladdin. But to today's kids, Disney is Hannah Montana and princesses.
There is a world where hope and dreams can last for all time.
Great for girls, but they're only half the market. Disney wants a little of this.
Dispatch, we're going to need reinforcements. Subjects are unarmed, but highly dangerous.
That's from X-Men, one of the new brands Disney gets by buying Marvel.
This is the wonderful world of getting into another set of chromosomes. You know, they got princesses and fairies and now, you know, Spider-Man.
That's Disney analyst Jim Hill. He says Marvel's characters will help Disney appeal to boys between the ages of 8 and 12. And that, he says, could be worth a lot more than the $4 billion Disney's paying.
You know, to be able to nail down that sort of demographic, to get that sort of loyalty and have them coming back to watch movies and buy merchandise or play online games, it's potentially huge for them.
And he says don't overlook the thousands of Marvel characters none of us has heard of, like Berserker, Black Death, and Flambe. After all, Hill says Disney has a knack for reviving old characters. Entertainment industry analyst Hal Vogel isn't buying it.
You have to question whether these 40, 50, 60, 70-year-old comic book heroes are relevant, and can you refresh them for the new market? I'm not convinced of that.
Vogel says it's possible Marvel got the better deal. It couldn't get the cash it needed to grow, so why not cash out at a big premium?
Disney has the capital. The Marvel Entertainment guys don't.
Well, they do now. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This was a scary and smoky weekend in parts of the greater Los Angeles area. An enormous wildfire in the mountains north of town claimed the lives of two firefighters yesterday. The fire is at about 140 square miles and growing. The flames are also burning through California's Emergency Firefighting Fund. And with it, as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, the state's fragile budget.
When the wildfire season began here earlier this year, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger pledged he'd find adequate funding, never mind the state's huge budget shortfall.
We have a financial crisis in California, but I wanted to make sure that you all know that even though we have this crisis, we will not be short the money when it comes to fighting those fires.
Schwarzenegger set aside $182 million for wildfire costs, but even though the fire season started out relatively mild, half the money was gone as of a week ago. In the next couple of months are typically the busiest for firefighters as hot desert winds start to blow. Carol Wills speaks for the California Professional Firefighters Association. He fears it's local fire departments that will ultimately come up short.
Local governments are the backbone of the mutual aid system in California. California becomes one big fire department when an incident like this happens, and they draw resources from all over the state.
The worry is California could be slow to reimburse local governments, and their firefighters could simply stop showing up when they're needed. Federal grants can ultimately cover up to 75% of firefighting costs, but Will says some local governments are still waiting for federal money from as far back as 2 years ago. In the end, he says the lack of funds means public safety can suffer.
It has the potential for leaving localities vulnerable to smaller fires that occur in their own backyards.
Wills says the cost of fighting these wildfires has been rising steadily as once remote areas have been developed. Where the focus had been on simply containing the flames, saving lives and property has become a much more expensive task. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Some cities up near the fire have canceled the first day of school. It was supposed to have been today. A lot of college students around the country have either started classes already or are about to. And as they choose their course loads for the semester amid rising tuition costs, there is less and less enthusiasm for the old standby majors like history or political science or biology. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that today's students want something that sells.
Mark Taylor is a tenured religion professor at Columbia University. But he compares higher education to the Detroit Big Three.
So they're producing a product for which there's no market.
Which wouldn't be so bad if those students also had skills valued outside academia. But
the skills that they are giving them are, in many, many instances, unrelated to the world in which they're going to work.
Taylor thinks universities should build curriculums around real-world problems, like energy or water management. Right now, he says, universities are too academically specialized. Students end up knowing far too much about far too narrow a subject. He believes the system will eventually collapse under its own weight.
When students are paying $200,000 for a college education, and only 19% of the graduating seniors this spring have jobs, people are going to begin to ask whether it's worth that kind of money.
He says curriculum should be multidisciplinary and should change with the changing needs of society. Karen Fisher at the Chronicle of Higher Education sees some of that happening already. Popular new majors include public health and sustainability.
Some of these majors were really there in response to the needs of the business community.
Like service science, the goal to spur innovation in the service industries. Health IT and computational science are also trendy. But Fisher's co-author, David Glenn, isn't convinced philosophy or English majors are doomed. He says what businesses need in a rapidly changing economy is critical thinking skills.
There have been prophets for 40 or 50 years who have predicted that college will radically change, and in most ways it hasn't.
Who knows? Perhaps reading Marx prepares you better for a career in customer service than majoring in service science. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I don't know what they were reading on Wall Street today, but it sure wasn't a thriller. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Came across some interesting numbers in the financial press this morning. First, that the Treasury Department has raked in a profit of $4 billion so far from the TARP. That's the bank bailout that's almost a year old now. Also, that the Federal Reserve is $14 billion to the good on its bailout-related expenses. That sounded, honestly, high. So we called economist Douglas Elliott to talk about it. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Doug, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai.
Seems to me what we need is a definition of terms here as we start figuring out how much money the government has gotten back. Are we actually making profits yet, or are we just recouping capital that we have laid out?
We're making profits on a few of the deals where it's closed. Some of the strongest banks have been in a position to pay us back. We know on those banks we've made money. What we don't know is whether we'll make or lose money on the rest of the banks.
And just to get some sense of it, we've still got something like $100 billion, $130 billion of the TARP program outstanding to the banks, right? Big ones like Citigroup and Bank of America.
We have a lot that's still out there. And so if things go badly, we could end up losing money overall. I think the good news here, though, is not so much that we might make some money. It's that we could be talking about the possibility of making money when that isn't why we even went into this. The government put the taxpayer money into these banks because we were looking at the abyss. Mm-hmm. We were afraid back in October that the financial system might crater and we might have a true depression instead of just a very severe recession. So the fact we might break even or even make some money is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I saw a great quote the other day from somebody. It said, possibility of making $10 or $20 billion on the TARP, $10 or $20 billion, possibility of averting financial apocalypse, priceless, really.
Well, yes, exactly.
Let me ask you about the other institution very involved in this whole bailout mechanism, and that's the Federal Reserve. You know, for the $700 billion that the Treasury Department is into the bailout, the Fed has trillions of dollars on the line in loan guarantees and mortgage-backed securities and all of those things that it went out there and created new money for. How are we going to know how the Fed's doing?
We're not going to know how the Fed is doing for quite some time. And the Fed has taken the less riskier part of the activity. It's true they put more money out there, but each dollar at risk is not at nearly as much risk. But that all said, it all depends on how the markets and the economy develop, and it'll be a while.
Just to get back to this idea of profits before we let you go, is it really just silly to be talking about profits at all when we're talking about this bailout?
I don't think it's silly to be talking about profits. You just have to focus on the most important thing, which is this program made sense if it's true we were up against the edge and the program stopped it, which I believe. If you don't believe that, then we shouldn't have done it. That's the key.
Yeah, but at this point, it's a little late, right?
Sure. We're just looking in retrospect.
Yeah, of course. Douglas Elliott from the Brookings Institution. Douglas, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Not too far below healthcare on the legislative agenda when Congress gets back to work next week, we'll be coming up with new rules for how Wall Street does business. A lot of the discussion so far has been about protecting consumers from potential wrongs they don't even know about. Forget the bigger problems of toxic assets and collateralized debt obligations for a second. What if your financial advisor is selling you an investment that he or his firm stand to profit from? From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
I'm going to use one of those jargony finance words we at Marketplace generally try to avoid, fiduciary.
A fiduciary duty is the responsibility to act in the best interest of your clients.
That's Barbara Roper. She's Director of Investor Protection at the Consumer Federation of America. Roper says there are basically two kinds of people you can go to for financial advice. You can go to a registered investment advisor or a registered broker-dealer. One big difference, investment advisors are required by law to put your interests ahead of their own. Broker-dealers are not. Roper says they have to sell you products that are suitable, but not necessarily in your best interest.
Broker-dealers give extensive investment advice, but they're regulated as salespeople and have not been subject to a fiduciary duty. However, they call themselves financial advisors, they offer advisory services, they market themselves based on the advice offered, and this, of course, creates a great deal of consumer confusion.
I'll say the Obama administration wants to cut through that confusion by applying the same fiduciary duty to anyone who gives investment advice. The broker-dealer industry has fought the idea for years. Critics say brokers make a lot of money selling their firm's own products when a competitor's might be better or cheaper for you. But since the financial crisis, the industry's changed its position. Ira Hammerman is general counsel at the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, or SIFMA. That's the brokerage industry's main trade group. He admits there are flaws in the system.
We owe investors clarity, and we do not have clarity today. So what we would like to see is a new federal standard, a high standard, and one that offers consistent protection to investors across the land.
But what exactly will that standard be? That's where the fight is shaping up. Consumer advocate Barbara Roper says the brokerage industry doesn't want a real fiduciary standard, but a watered-down fiduciary light. She says SIFMA supports a standard that only applies when brokers give financial advice, not when they actually sell whatever mutual fund or other product they advise you to buy.
An approach that would be poorly understood by investors and an invitation to abuse.
Roper says, for example, a broker would be held to a fiduciary standard when advising you to buy a growth stock mutual fund. But when it came time to sell the product, he might be inclined to push the one that earned him a higher commission. The Obama administration has proposed that the SEC look into these sorts of conflicts and ban forms of compensation that may be harmful to investors. Dale Brown is CEO of the Financial Services Institute, a group representing broker-dealers and financial advisors. He, and pretty much everyone I talk to, says it's impossible to rid the advice industry of conflicts.
What's important, I believe, is not that there are conflicts of interest. There are. But it's how are those conflicts disclosed and managed so that the investor gets the advice and help and service that they need.
Brown says there's nothing wrong with the commission-based business model. He says it makes advice accessible to people who might not be able to afford an advisor who charges a fee. Andy Rosenfield is CEO of Guggenheim Investment Advisors, a firm that markets itself as conflict-free. He says even when conflicts are disclosed, investors don't always read the disclosure or understand it.
When I get a prescription from a doctor, it comes with a 5-page printed sort of insert that you unfold. I seldom read it. On the other hand, if the prescription says on the face, "Don't be in the sun," you understand.
The investing equivalent might be a simple notice saying this broker receives compensation from a third party. That would be one way of letting investors decide whether the advice benefits them or their broker. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, the fantasy and reality of ethanol.
We have to kiss a lot of frogs to locate projects. And it was unfortunately one that we put several years' worth of time and effort into, and they didn't turn out.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a bad day, but still a very good month on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.5% today, 47 points, closed at 9,496. The Nasdaq shaved off just under 1%, 19 points, finished at 2009. The S&P 500 reversed 0.8%, 8 points, ended the day at 1,020 for the month, and it was a beaut. The Dow was up 3.5%. The S&P 500 padded on 3.4%. The Nasdaq climbed 1.5%. As we told you earlier, big doings in Hollywood today. Shares in Marvel Entertainment bulked up more than 25% on the news it would be bought by Disney. DreamWorks Animation drew up a 6.5% increase today in hopes that it, too, would be acquired by somebody, I suppose. Disney, on the other hand, fell nearly 3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.4%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com.
We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for July. Major U.S. automakers unveil sales figures for the month of August. numbers are expected to be up due to cash for clunkers rebate incentives. And the Institute of Medicine releases a new report addressing childhood obesity prevention at the local level. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Two items from the music world to get us going on this next story. The new video from Madonna's greatest hits album, Celebration, will debut on iTunes tomorrow as a free download. Also tomorrow, fans of Jay-Z can listen to his new album for free almost 2 weeks before its official rollout. For most consumers, music is all about digital nowadays, even if a whole lot of record executives haven't been so eager to embrace it. For them, online distribution is the kiss of death, or close to it. But Greg Kot has a different take. He's the music critic for the Chicago Tribune. He also hosts a public radio program on music called Sound Opinions, produced, as we are, by American Public Media. And he's got a new book out about music in the internet age called Ripped, in which he says the digital revolution that has come to the recording industry is far from all bad.
There is a part of the music industry that's dying as a result of what's happening on the internet, but I think a new industry is being born, a grassroots industry.
Walk me through the business model then. These bands, whether they're established or up-and-comers, they get to go directly to the fans. How does that business model work? How do people make money out of that?
I think what it comes down to is building a community around what an artist may do. I think what was happening in the past, where everything was being funneled through a few big corporations, a few big record companies, a few big radio stations, fans really didn't feel personally invested in the artists. And what the internet has facilitated is artists communicating directly with their fans and vice versa, you know, to the point where you have fans participating in the art, you know, whether it's making videos or doing remixes, they feel part of the equation. And as a result, they're investing in the artist in numerous ways.
Who's doing it really well, though, Greg?
I think some of the biggest examples, the most well-known examples, are bands like Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails.
But Radiohead and a guy like Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, they are established artists, right? They've got the fan base out there. How does this work to the advantage of a newer artist who's just getting started, has great stuff, but needs that outlet, that distribution channel?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and my simple solution to it is be good. You know, it's very hard to keep a secret on the internet. If your music is genuinely good, you will not be a secret for very long. I think the key is start small, start with a community base, start with a few hardcore fans, and build it from there. And secondly, lower your overhead. Keep your operation small and surround yourself with a few invested businessmen. In other words, you still need infrastructure, but it should be a lot smaller.
So who's good right now?
There's a ton of people out there that are making music that's amazing. I mean, the reason Lil Wayne is one of the rap superstars now is that he was constantly distributing these mixtapes through illicit channels on the web and getting this music to his fans and getting fans excited about him and his personality and what he was doing. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot more stars developing out of it.
There is an element of the free business model here, right? You give a bunch of stuff away to hope that you attract more fans who will then, after hearing a song or two, maybe pony up 10 bucks to buy the album online.
Yes, people need to hear the music before they want to purchase, before they want to invest in you. The whole notion that the music industry has been operating under for the last 10, 15 years is that every download represents a lost sale. You know, what has radio been except for a free download? I mean, people want to hear the music first before they invest in it. If it's good, they're going to want more of it, not less.
Does this mean then, you know, the increasing nichification of this music, right, where bands go out and find fans who like this band in particular, does that mean the days of the blockbuster, globe-shattering bands like U2 and the Rolling Stones are done with?
Yeah, you know, and I'm crying a bitter tear here because those days are gone. I'm saying, what have we lost there? Seeing a mega band in a stadium, that's a good experience for somebody? You know, I mean, I've been in the last row for Rolling Stones show, Kai. It's not a lot of fun back there.
Greg Kot is the music critic for the Chicago Tribune. He hosts a public radio program on music called Sound Opinions, and also he writes books. He's the author of Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. Greg, thanks a lot.
Kai, my pleasure.
You remember ethanol? Not too long ago, it was the way this country was going to wean itself off imported crude. In 2007, Congress set hard targets for how much ethanol refiners would have to blend in with their gasoline. And it was a lot, too. 11 billion gallons this year, nearly 13 billion next year. Most, if not all, of that ethanol was expected to be corn-based. And that helped unleash a flood of money into what was then a budding ethanol industry. But as Adam Allington reports now from KWMU in St. Louis, the current investment forecast for ethanol is drought.
Mitch Robinson looks out over 300 acres of prime Mississippi River bottomland near Cape Girardeau, Missouri. It's wet and fertile, a great place to grow corn. In 2007, this site was slated to be part of a new ethanol industry in the area.
There was plans going on at one time for four ethanol plants that would have been in a 25-mile radius. And after we had four identified, people kept calling and said, well, you know, we want to come look. And we kept telling people, well, you know, you're too late.
Robinson works for a regional development group in southeast Missouri. At the time, cheap corn and high gas prices were driving a rush of investment in corn ethanol here and across the Midwest. Robinson says those four refineries would have added hundreds of jobs and millions of dollars to the region's economy, but they never got past the planning stage.
We'd have to kiss a lot of frogs to locate projects, and it was unfortunately one that we put several years' worth of time an effort into, and they didn't turn out.
Interest in ethanol has all but dried up after corn prices shot up last year and investment crumbled under the weight of the recession. Dozens of refineries either went bankrupt or never broke ground. Alex Molia runs a corporate restructuring firm in Chicago with lots of clients in the ethanol industry.
Many of these ethanol plants were built on a hope and a prayer, completely dependent on market demand and commodity price fluctuations.
Given those fluctuations, Molia says the refineries that survived the shakeout can still lose a ton of money if they misread the futures market on corn. Corn's currently trading at just over $3 a bushel, roughly half of what it was at this time last year, but still higher than it was before the ethanol boom. Molia questions whether there are enough refineries to meet the new federal ethanol target, let alone triple production as the government would like by 2022. Many biofuels advocates are pinning their hopes on next-generation energy crops like switchgrass and algae. But not everyone is ready to close the book on corn.
There has literally been no investment in genetics of switchgrass.
Mark Beamer is the CEO of Alternative Energy Sources in Kansas City. He says substitutes to corn ethanol are still years away from large-scale production.
When you compare that to the corn industry where Monsanto, Syngenta, Pioneer are investing $1 billion a year in corn genetics to increase yields, it's almost laughable that everyone wants to talk about switchgrass.
The economics of corn ethanol could also change. The Environmental Protection Agency is considering raising ethanol's gasoline blend requirement from 10 to 15%. That increased demand might be enough to trump investor fears over volatile corn prices. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, which comes with the observation that it was 105 degrees this weekend at my house. The 2010 edition of the Farmer's Almanac goes on sale tomorrow. Predictions are for freezing cold and much snow across most of the country this winter. Sadly, the National Weather Service says it will actually be milder than usual thanks to an El Nino out here in the Pacific Ocean. The Farmer's Almanac, by the way, is not to be confused with the old Farmer's Almanac. You'll learn something new every day. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow fell 47 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq lost 19 points, just under 1%. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.8%. Not a bad August, though, if you really think about it. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, what not to wear to the bank.
We're not trying to be the fashion police, so to speak. It's a matter of, hey, you know, we need to be able to see their faces.
Stick them up. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.